Daniel proceeds through symbols up to the 11th chapter in describing prophetic history of the kingdoms growing out of Nebuchadnezzar's beastly kingdom. The golden head of the image, like a man, through the silver, the brass, and the legs of iron, and the feet of clay and iron. Babylon, Medo-Persian, Grecian, Roman kingdom, ten-toed kingdom of the end. And then it proceeds through beastly kingdoms. The lion, comparable to the head, in Daniel's prophecy, the first being Nebuchadnezzar's dream, then Daniel had one. The bear, analogous to the Medo-Persian. The leopard, analogous to Alexander the Great's Grecian kingdom. The nondescript beast, smashing everything, analogous to the legs of iron. The ten horns, analogous to the ten toes. Then, like a zoom lens, another vision focuses on only two kingdoms. Again, different animals symbolize, but it's two of the same kingdoms. The ram to symbolize Medo-Persian, the goat that conquered it to symbolize Alexander the Great. A notable horn to give more detail, symbolizing Alexander the Great himself, broken off in its prime, replaced by four. Then the focus among those four on two of the horns that represent two of the four generals who took sections of Alexander the Great's kingdom. The Seleucid, taking the area that encompasses Iran, Iraq, Transjordan, the Arabian area, southern Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, and the Ptolemies, Egypt. The purpose of that vision is to give us detail, clarifying that Antichrist will rise up in the area of the Seleucid kingdom, that portion of Alexander the Great's kingdom that embraced the area of, as just said, Iraq, Iran, Transjordan, Syria, southern Turkey, etc. By the 11th chapter, after a departure that gives more detail and substance to the doctrine of angels and demons, and the princes in the evil hierarchy of supernatural beings that truly do dominate and rule over Persia and over Greece, referred to as the Prince of Persia and the Prince of Greece, conquered by Michael and Gabriel, angels, Michael the Prince of Princes in that reference. By the 11th chapter, multitudinous detail is given as though the focus meter is turned into a microscope. And the entire 11th chapter of Daniel, up to and through the 20th chapter, or 20th verse of that chapter, is a constant repetition of a seesaw between the king of the north, which is the Seleucid kingdom, Iran, Iraq, southern Turkey, Syria, Transjordan, as said, and the king of the south, which is Egypt. Indeed, the Septuagint version, which is the one available and used by the Christians of the first century, quoted by Jesus, quoted by the apostles, doesn't even use the phrase that's in the King James, king of the south. It refers bluntly to the king of Egypt. Or rather, through the 19th verse. In the 19th verse in the King James, "Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found." That's about as far as the commentators can take it through the 19th verse in locating the specific personalities ruling and involved in the seesaw battles between the king of the north, the Seleucid kingdom, and the king of the south, Egypt. You find Cleopatra. You find the Roman forces moving in that drive this king of the north, or the Seleucid ruler at the time of the Roman extension of its power, into the territory of Alexander the Great's kingdoms, conquering both Egypt and the Seleucid portions. This king of the north, in verse 19, shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. The 20th verse, how many of you have in your Bible from past preaching on the book of Daniel, the little symbol, the letters written in the margin where I told you to put Antichrist, is between this 19th and 20th verse that the gap occurs. And the 20th verse begins to describe happenings that lead up to the reign of Antichrist and the end. How many of you have an AC written by that 20th verse? Get a camera on the hand so they can see how many are there. Find a place. Hold them up, folks. Camera, find a place where more people are. There you go. So I've taught on this before. And you have AC for Antichrist. Now, I want to show you how confused. I'm looking at the old pulpit commentary, the Anglican Church dominated product of multiple scholars, brilliant scholars, capable scholars. Up to this 20th verse, they can pretty clearly find the historic personages that are identified. Now, it seems almost ridiculous. And the world has been dominated by the United States, dominated by Arab kingdoms that have spread south and west and east, dominated by the great Slavic kingdoms formed to the north, the Celtic kingdoms of northwest Europe, to have this marvelous book by Daniel that portrays God's control over history, focus an entire chapter on what looks like a teapot with consistent tempest, but what in the large world frame the natural man would consider a lot of attention to detail that is nothing more than multiplied tempest in a little teapot. The purpose is to set the stage for knowing where to look for Antichrist, because he's going to start coming forth about verse 20. Let me show you the confusion that reigns. The King James, verse 20, "Then shall stand up in his estate." Most of you will have a number by that word that'll refer you to the margin of your Bible for the alternate translation that says place. How many have that? Plenty of you. So just as accurately you say place, because what we're talking about is a geographic place. And the place where this northern king, the successor ruler to the Seleucid portion of Alexander the Great's kingdom, who disappeared in verse 19 in the years before Christ, then shall stand up in his place, look in the same geographic region, the same place that Antiochus Epiphanes came forth and produced the Maccabean rebellion by his decrees, driven back toward the fort of his own land by the encroachment of the conquering Romans who would rule Palestine in the time of Christ. In the place of that one, the Seleucid kingdom, Iraq, western Iran, southern Turkey, Syria, Transjordan, somewhere in that geographic area, shall stand up, the King James says, a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. Now, what in the hell does that mean? But within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Verse 21. And his in his estate. How many have a number that goes to the margin that says place? And in his place shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken. By the way, a lot of people will read that overthrown in a hurry. It's overflown, assuming that's accurate, from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Which could imply the prince of the covenant himself is overthrown, but since the prince of the covenant is not overthrown, by elimination, you know, that's not the interpretation. Rather, it is simply a recognition declaration that the one who with the arms of a flood shall have them overflown from before him and broken, the one who does this is the prince of the covenant. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully. For he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. He shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches. Yea, he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. If that's an accurate translation, that means he'll do this for a year. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south, Septuagint says, the king of Egypt, with a great army. And the king of the south, Septuagint says, king of Egypt, shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him. Somebody that's close to him eats with him. And his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief. They shall speak lies at one table. So on. Let's go back to 20 and 21. Then shall stand up in his estate or place a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle, and in his place shall stand up a vile person. That means the stage for Antichrist is two steps. This so-called raiser of taxes. And then in his place a vile person. So I'll give you comfort. The tax raiser doesn't last long. Now, those that are forever picking on somebody and saying, here's the Antichrist. He has to have a prelude. A guy that didn't last too long, here called the raiser of taxes, and in his place, a vile person who comes in by flatteries. Now, to those that are making Saddam Hussein the Antichrist, well, where is this raiser of taxes and the glory of the kingdom that within a few days is destroyed neither in anger nor in battle that preceded him? Or is he, Saddam, this prelude? And somebody after him comes in peaceably and with flatteries. Well, when you recognize that, you got some new problems, some additional problems, rather. Not only is any comments about this usually worthless because they're trying to find somebody in the first century B.C. that fits the bill, when the gap has occurred between the 19th and 20th verse, and we're in the last days at the start of the 20th verse, you got some problem with renditions, because every copier and every translator wrestled with the problem. Let me show you some of them. Going out the gate, King James says, then shall stand up in his estate or place a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed neither in anger nor in battle. And we know this is a predecessor, prelude, immediate to Antichrist himself. But if we go to the Bible that Jesus used, the Bible that Paul used, the Bible the apostles used, the rendering of the Septuagint differs very much from what is in the King James, Book of Daniel. Septuagint reads, in place of then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. Here's what the Bible Jesus read from says. Then shall a plant arise out of his root to the restoration of the kingdom, a man striking the glory of a king. That's not even on the same planet in semantical meaning. Now, who are you going to take? These King James people who decided that after the Jews began to react to the Septuagint, even though they translated it and it was their Bible translated by Jewish scholars into the Greek at Alexandria, because of the use by the Christians of the Septuagint, it began to be called the Christian's Bible, which created the pressure among Jewish scholars to go behind the Septuagint and produce an authorized text in Hebrew, utilizing other manuscripts, much as the uncovering of additional Greek manuscripts results in revised versions in today's world. But considering Jesus' use of Daniel and his respect for Daniel, as exhibited in his use of Daniel, and the fact that he used the Septuagint, since there's confusion, as you're going to see in a minute, I feel a little safer with the Septuagint than I do whatever the sources were that produced the rendition of verse 20 in the King James. And I find it easier to look for this person with the phrase, then shall a plant arise out of his root to the restoration of the kingdom, a man striking the glory of a king. Well, I'm not saying Saddam Hussein fits this, but he sure fits it a hell of a lot better than he does raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. He revels in being identified with Nebuchadnezzar. And geographically, he's certainly a plant, Iraq, arising out of the root of that Seleucid kingdom. Alexander the Great made his capital at Babylon. The Seleucid kingdom kept one of its capitals at Babylon, the main capital. Then shall a plant arise out of his root to the restoration of the kingdom, a man striking the glory of a king. And then the commentators say it's impossible to find any connection between the opening clause of this and the corresponding clause in the Masoretic, which is an orthodox source for Jewry. And the first clause, these commentators point out, as several others do, the first clause of verse 21. Go to verse 21, and in his place shall stand up a vile person. The Septuagint. The first clause of verse 21 in the Septuagint really belongs to verse 20 and reads thus: in the last days he shall be broken, not in wrath, nor in war. Now, that would be very comforting, wouldn't it, if Saddam is this plant, rising out of the root of the kingdom, a man striking the glory of a king, and the 21st verse, first phrase, belongs to this verse, which is where it is in the Septuagint: in the last days he shall be broken, not in wrath, nor in war. But look at this confusion. I'll just take other sources of renderings of this text that the scholars used to produce a translation like the King James, without identifying them except by naming them, because my time right now is not to be spent on the sources of the Bible, but to show you how much confusion exists. Theodotion agrees in the first clause with the Septuagint, but is equally unintelligible. His translation is, there shall arise out of his root one removing a plant of the kingdom. On his preparation he shall act the glory of the kingdom. Yet in those days he shall be broken, and not openly nor in war shall he stand. Another source, the Peshitta, renders, quote, in his stead shall one stand up who shall cause a ruler to pass through even the glory of your kings. And in a few days he shall be destroyed, not in tumult nor in battle. The Vulgate, Authorized Catholic Version, Jerome's product. The Vulgate renders, quote, in his stead shall stand up a vile person and unworthy of royal dignity. And in a few days he shall be broken, not in fury nor in battle. Then they try to find the reference in the first century B.C. Difficult as this, as is the interpretation of the words, just as difficult is it to find out the reference. And then they go into confusion, having named two or three candidates, none of whom really fit the bill, as they point out, because this person is not found in first century B.C. They then go to the next phrase. Verse 20, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. They then say, well, if you take this phrase, all their choices to try to apply the first phrase don't fit, and they go into a long expression about that. Then comes the soccer. The Greek version, Septuagint, does not give this clause. Well, then that takes us back to simply this. Then shall a plant arise out of his root, Septuagint. Then shall a plant arise out of his root to the restoration of the kingdom, a man striking the glory of a king. The few days, not in war, not in battle, is left out. And in his place shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, which allows more time to get rid of the first one and to have the second one come in by flatteries. And the only thing that there's agreement about is if the phrase that's not in the Septuagint is there, as it is in the other sources, then his destruction will be not in war and not in battle. But if the Greek is correct, that phrase isn't there. All we have, a little more like the way prophecy reads when it moves into that future zone, is you have this plant out of the root that will rise up in the glory of a king. He won't last, and in his place will be someone who comes in peaceably and with flattery, who will come up with a peace plan after a temporary overflow of arms, which we know will occur in the overthrow of some of the little horns before they give him the kingdom. In either case, Saddam's not the Antichrist. If he is any part, well, he certainly is in the area, but if he is part of 20 or 21, then he's the first guy, not the second guy. And he ain't going to last too long, historically speaking. Now, I'd like to take some time and teach on this. So why don't you get the job done? Because that's all you're going to get tonight on that subject. Take heart. Saddam ain't him. The Lord's not going to come. For the rest of this year, because his date's done passed. And he ain't coming by September of next year either. So don't panic. We got a job to do, so get on telephone. And furthermore, this is not prelude to Armageddon on the borders of Kuwait in Saudi Arabia. Doesn't make it any easier for the guys that are there. But this ain't the big one. Anaheim, as a Catholic, I enjoy what you teach on. And I've watched you quite a few times and sends a contribution. Redondo Beach, my numbers are in. I've pumped into another channel by accident, and I heard that the King of Spain is going to be the Antichrist. I've met him, and no way. No way. Islam and the Arab world. The call first came to Muhammad when he was approaching his 40th year. The traditional Muslim biography of the prophet tells that on a night in the month of Ramadan, the angel Gabriel came to him as he slept in solitude on Mount Hira and said, "Recite." Muhammad hesitated. And three times the angel nearly stifled him until Muhammad asked, "What shall I recite?" This is the official version. Then the angel said, quote, "Recite in the name of thy Lord who created all things, who created man from clots of blood. Recite, for thy Lord is the most generous, who taught with a pen, who taught man what he did not know." There's an awful lot of ignorance of the bases of the Islamic faith among Westerners. And the very least we better begin to do is respect the genuineness of their commitment to what they believe, or we'll never understand the dedication of their soldiers. These words just read form the first four verses of the 96th chapter of the Quran. Quran is an Arabic word meaning reading or recitation, and is used to describe the book containing the revelations which Muslims believe were given by God to Muhammad. After this first message, Muhammad received many more, which he brought to the people of his birthplace, urging them to abandon their idolatrous beliefs and practices and to believe in one, single, universal God, Allah. Muhammad was born in the small oasis town of Mecca, which will explain to you why Mecca is important to Muslims, in the region known as the Hejaz, in western Arabia, in about AD 571. The peninsula at that time lay on the margins of the civilized world, in touch with both the Byzantine and Persian empires, but subject to neither. Most of the population were nomads who lived attending their herds and berating rival tribes and the people of the oases and of the borderlands. Some tilled the soil in the few areas where this was possible. Some, by commerce, made their living during periods when events in the outside world led to a revival of interest in the Trans-Arabian trade routes. The resumption of conflict between Byzantium and Persia, the rival imperial powers that confronted each other in the Middle East after more than a century of peace, was such a time, and both empires became very active in commerce in and near Arabia during the 6th century. A few small towns lived on a share in the traffic that passed through Arabia between the Mediterranean world and the East. And one of these towns was Mecca, originally a southern Arabian settlement, later inhabited by the Arab tribe of Quraysh. The people of the peninsula, the Arabs, had a common literary language and a rich poetic literature which helped greatly to give them a common sense of identity. But they had no common political order, and in their religious beliefs they were still pagans, worshiping various gods whom they believed to be under the authority of one supreme God called Allah. They were acquainted with other religions. There were colonies of Christians and Jews in Arabia, and some Arabs were converted by them to Christianity or Judaism. Others became dissatisfied with the idol worship of their people, but were unable to find satisfaction in either the Christian or Jewish faiths. These are known in the Arab tradition as Hanifs. Muhammad's preaching in Mecca began to win converts, first in his own family and then in wider circles. After a while, it aroused opposition among the leading families of Mecca, who regarded this new preaching as a threat both to their faith and to their interests. Pressures of various kinds, perhaps even physical violence, were used to detach Muhammad's followers from him. Relations between the Prophet and his compatriots became worse and worse, until some of his converts were impelled to take refuge in Ethiopia. Then, in the year AD 622, about 13 years after his first call, Muhammad made an agreement with emissaries from Yathrib, another town in the Hejaz, some 280 miles north of Mecca. The people of Yathrib agreed to welcome him among them, to make him their arbitrator, and to defend him, and those converts who came with him from Mecca would also be defended as they would defend themselves. Muhammad sent the 60-odd families in Mecca who had joined him, a few at a time, to Yathrib. He himself finally followed them, probably in September 622. Yathrib now became the center of the new faith and community, and came to be known simply as Medina, Al-Medina, the city. The migration of Muhammad and his followers from Mecca to Medina, called in Arabic the Hijra, is regarded by Muslims as the decisive moment in the mission of their prophet. It is from the year in which it took place that the Muslim calendar is reckoned, so that year one of the Hijra began in 622 A.D. In Mecca, Muhammad had been a private person, preaching a new faith against the indifference or hostility of the ruling powers. In Medina, he was first a chief and then a ruler, wielding political and military as well as religious authority. This new role, both political and military as well as religious, is reflected in the teachings and activities of Muhammad himself and in the kind of revelations required for the guidance of his community. Whereas the Meccan chapters of the Quran are concerned chiefly with questions of doctrine and ethics, the Medina chapters deal with many legal and political matters, with problems that arose in the day-to-day life of the Muslim community, which had, after the migration, become a Muslim polity. For 10 years after the Hijra, the Prophet presided over the Muslim community in both war and peace and instructed them in the Islamic faith. His influence was extended by persuasion and by arms, and in the year 9 or 630 AD, Mecca itself was conquered and brought into the Muslim fold. On June 8, 11 or 632, the Prophet died after a short illness. He had achieved great things. To the peoples of Western Arabia, he had brought a religion which, with its monotheism and its ethical doctrines, stood on an incomparably higher level than the paganism that it had replaced. He had brought the believers a book of revelations, which was to become, in the centuries to follow, the guide to thought, faith, and conduct of countless millions. He had established a new community and a new state, well organized and well armed, the power and prestige of which made it a dominant factor in Arabia. The word Islam is commonly understood by Muslims and others to mean surrender, that is, of the believer to God. And unlike Christians who mouth it, even fundamentalist Christians, the fundamentalist Muslims are Islamic. They are surrendered. They have surrendered to God. The active participle of the same verb, Muslim, means one who performs the act of surrender. It is likely that the word originally conveyed a somewhat different notion, that of entirety. The Muslim in this sense was one who gave himself entirely to God alone, to the exclusion of others. And he is guaranteed entrance into heaven when his surrender to God in holy war, jihad, brings him death. Our boys want to get home. Their boys want to go with Allah. I think it's kind of interesting. There are no snakes in Ireland. Every snake in Arabia is poisonous. Think on that for a while. Now, let me say that again with precision. There are no poisonous snakes of any kind in Ireland. Every snake in Saudi Arabia is poisonous. And one of our soldiers went for a walk at night wearing thongs. And he's in a hospital in Germany from a bite on the toe. I mean, rattlesnakes are bad. Puff adders and pit vipers. Make them look like bumblebees. Now, why is it all them poisonous snakes are there and there aren't any in Ireland? Think about that.